The Warfare Series, Part 1, Defining Enemies. When Yeshua came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" So they said, "Some say John the Immerser, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living Elohim." Yeshua answered him and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my assembly, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Matthew 16:13-18. Words mean things. While it is imperative to understand the actual meaning of the words of Scripture, what is going on in the background of how history and geography affected those Hebrews who penned those words is just as important to understand. Wars, both physical as well as theological, have long been waged over this passage from Matthew 16 as a result of not considering the influence original history and geography had on the shaping of those words. As exposed in previous articles, even though the phrase "the church" is found not to be a scriptural entity, it still has become the foundation of a new covenant, replacing the promise of the Hebrew Elohim to Israel and the subsequent deliberate process of separating Hellenistic Christianity from Hebraism. Thus, a reinterpretation of the Hebrew messianic writings became necessary to justify replacing the only true Holy One of Israel spoken of entirely in Scripture with another universal God of mankind, but yet still seemed to be compatible with Hebrew Scripture. This new Roman religion, for that is what Christianity became, soon did not tolerate members professing to be Christian while retaining Hebrew practices, eventually causing them to disappear as a movement. Consequently, in order to be considered Christian, even today, one becomes obligated to reject Hebraism. However, in so doing, the perspective of these Hebrew writers, whose words were influenced by their Hebrew history and geography, is lost in 1700 years of changing cultural context, overriding the meaning of those words. Which brings us to the history and geography behind the words of Yeshua at the beginning of this article that were given in the region surrounding the city then known as Caesarea Philippi, known as Baal Hermon and Baal Gad in the original writings, which was located at the foot of Mount Hermon in the Golan Heights, just to the north of the Kinneret, or Sea of Galilee. Outside the city was a sacred precinct from which flowed one of the largest springs feeding the Jordan River. The abundant water supply made the area very fertile and attractive for religious worship. Today, the area is a nature reserve, while also preserving the remains of a pagan culture which once included a temple, courtyards, and a cave. Without an appreciation of this geography within the context of his words, it is nearly impossible to understand the exchange Yeshua makes with his disciples in one of the most recognized pagan sites in Israel. A massive rock, hundreds of feet long and high, stands before them, At its base is a giant grotto considered by pagan worshippers to be a passage into the underworld. This is the place of the gods, and here it becomes appropriate for Yeshua to ask, "Who do you think that I am?" Now, with this geography in mind, let's look again at Matthew 16 from the history surrounding the words of Yeshua. When our modern translations quote Peter as saying, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," there are two glaring discrepancies with the history of the Hebrew people in that translation. Before those discrepancies are expounded upon, however, it is important to remember that these were Hebrews speaking in their native tongue of Hebrew to each other, while Greek certainly was the universal language spoken between citizens of different cultures mixing regularly, probably between Yeshua, who spoke Hebrew, and Pilate, who spoke Latin, the language of Rome. Those of the same ethnic origin spoke the same language they were raised in and had in common, as they still do today. Among each other, Hebrew spoke Hebrew. This fact is validated in the inscription placed above Yeshua's head at his crucifixion that was written in the three commonly spoken languages of the day, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. We also can see that phenomena present in the world still today. Even though English has become the universal language, those raised in their native France still speak French to their neighbors, and in Japan they speak Japanese among themselves, etc. We must also be constantly reminded that there were no Christians around when these words were spoken. That religion did not begin appearing in history for another 150 to 200 years. Consequently, the first discrepancy in this verse is found in the term Christ, coined from the Greek word Christos, meaning anointed, to support the agenda of this new religion, which was added only at a later date to the Greek manuscripts by Latin translators from which the English is derived. The Hebrew word for anointed used throughout the original writings is Mashiach, which is more correctly translated as Messiah. This subtle change underscores the deliberate separation from the Hebrew origin and purpose describing the person. Secondly, the English word God in this verse is translated from the Greek theos, whose definition is a god or goddess, a general name given to deities. But since the Greeks worship multiple deities, we see this cultural influence overriding the translation of the Hebrew name Elohim, also translated as God in Genesis 1:1. But Elohim is specific and unique to Hebraic thinking, occurring only in Hebrew and in no other ancient Semitic language. So Peter's exclamation should more accurately be translated as, "You are the Mashiach, the Son of the living Elohim." Peter was speaking out of his Hebraic historical knowledge and relationship with the unique and only true Elohim of Israel, not some generalized God. The importance of translation in this verse will be seen a little further on. Yeshua responds with Simon Bar-Jonah, "How blessed you are, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but the Spirit of my Father in heaven." The Greek to English translation continues with Yeshua seemingly bestowing upon the person Simon Bar-Jonah a new name, accompanied with the charge of building Yeshua's invincible church. "And I also say that you are Peter," Greek Petros, "and upon this rock," the Greek Petra, "I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it." There are some glaring discrepancies with the conventional interpretation of this passage. The first is that Yeshua did not issue Simon a new name that day. The first report of Yeshua giving him a nickname is actually found in John 1:42, where in Hebrew he is called Shimon, known as Kepha, to the Greek Petros, to the English Peter. While the Greek Petros does mean rock, Kepha in Hebrew also means rock. He already was known as a rock prior to Yeshua using it that day. Aramaic words and expressions appear intermediately throughout the Messianic writings. The Aramaic word Cephas appears in John 1:42 in most English translations. As a sister language to Hebrew, it becomes most useful in giving insight to the actual words used in Hebrew by these Hebrews. Secondly, the conjunctive Greek word chai, translated and, grammatically can just as easily be translated but, which places an entirely different emphasis on the context. Finally, since the Greek word used for rock, Petra, sounds similar to the Greek name Petros, much has been made by biblical scholars over the wordplay between these two Greek words, which makes it seem logical this verse is about Peter. But we must remember that Yeshua did not speak from a Greek platform of logic. He said he did not speak anything unless he was first taught it from his Hebrew father. Thus, Yeshua was using Shimon's nickname for comparative purposes only. Whereas Kepha is called a rock, Yahweh is called the rock in Deuteronomy 32, 3-4, and described as the one whose work is perfect, from the Hebrew temim, meaning complete. If there's any wordplay involved, it would be Yeshua's use of the literal meaning of Kepha to bring together the understanding of the tesur, rock, used here in Deuteronomy. The more correct translation of this portion of the verse, without placing any preconceptions upon it, should be rendered, "And I also say that you are Kepha, a rock, but upon this rock, Yahweh, I will build." Yeshua is drawing from the historical Hebrew relationship with the Hebrew Elohim to make a statement concerning the faithfulness of Yahweh to complete his promise, something these non-gods under the boulder they are standing before are unable to do, and revealing the significance of Kepha's earlier conclusion of Yeshua being that promised Messiah. There is more. The Greek word translated as the English build is okiodomio and actually means to restore by building, to rebuild, to repair, to re-establish upon a foundation. The Hebrew word that is translated as the English new in Jeremiah 31:31-33 comes from the root word chadash, which means to make fresh, to renew, to repair. The same meaning as that found with the Greek word okiodomio. When Yeshua spoke to Peter in Matthew 16:18 that it is on this same rock of revelation that came to Peter he will build or establish his assembly, he was referencing this verse from Jeremiah. Yeshua was not saying he came to build something new from scratch, but to restore the covenant made before Abraham, and that the foundation, the rock, of that covenant would be an individual revelation of who he is, the kinsman redeemer of Israel, sent to restore the kingdom among Yahweh's family as it was in the beginning with Adam. All of these Hebrews who believed in the Hebrew Elohim were familiar with the purpose of the Messiah, to restore the kingdom of Yahweh to his family of Israel. The question posed in Yeshua's day was not whether Hebrews believed in Yahweh as their Elohim or not. They all believed, particularly concerning the disciples he was speaking to in this passage. That they were of faith was what made them Hebrew. The question was whether Yeshua was that promised Messiah sent by Elohim or not. As already exposed in the article, the church, the Greek word ecclesia, translated as the English word church in this passage from Matthew, is not a scriptural entity, not something new and unique to the Messianic writings. Rather, it becomes a traditional entity that instead should be read in the Hebrew context of Kehillah, or assembly, spoken of in Leviticus 8:4. Lastly, we come to the most glaring discrepancy of them all, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Hades is just another Greek mythological god, the god of the underworld. Yeshua does not believe in other gods, only in the Hebrew Elohim. Why then would he seemingly be ascribing power to a god he knows is non-existent? Again, when we remember that Yeshua said he did not speak anything unless he was first taught it from his Hebrew father, the Hebrew phrase the Hebrew Yeshua would be quoting is, "And your seed shall possess the gate of his, Yahweh's, enemies," found in the promise Yahweh made to Abraham concerning the Messiah. The Hebrew word yarash, translated possess, actually means to inherit, to occupy, which brings to the forefront the role of the status of the firstborn, the kinsman redeemer, as the inheritor of the promise of Yahweh. Now, understanding Yeshua's Hebrew perspective, we can see the enemies that the seed, the Messiah, shall inherit are Yahweh's enemies. Thus, the correct rendering of this passage from its original Hebrew perspective should be, "You are the Mashiach, the son of the living Elohim." Yeshua responds, "Shimon bar Yochanan, how blessed you are, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but the Spirit of my Father in heaven. And I also say you are Kepha, a rock, but upon this rock, Yahweh, I will restore his kingdom to the Kehillah by occupying the gate of his, Yahweh's, enemies." Again, Matthew 16:16-18. By reading this verse from its scriptural Hebrew perspective, the true meaning is placed back into the words, and this dynamic exchange taking place in this historical setting is restored. Yeshua was not creating a new religion with Peter as its chief administrator. He was solidifying the promise of the Father to restore what had been lost to his family Israel in the face of Yahweh's enemies. So then, just who are Yahweh's enemies? That Yeshua picked this spot, standing before this looming boulder, which is the centerpiece around the worship of so many pagan gods considered deities apart from the one true holy Elohim of Israel, should make it clear that Yahweh's enemies are non-gods that focus attention and faith away from the Elohim of Israel. They do this through the illusion of power, which is the gateway of fear, the fear of death. What is death? Romans 3:23 tells us that death is separation from the source of life. The condemnation spoken of by Yeshua in John 3:17-21 is translated from the Greek word krisis and means separation. To love darkness more than light is what separates men from Yahweh, the source of life, who is light, we're told in 1 John 1:5. This is where divorcement from Yahweh's words, mistakenly translated commandments, prevents a truthful understanding of Scripture. The first of Yahweh's words are, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself any graven image to bow down or to serve them." Why? Because verse 5 says those who do so hate Yahweh, the source of life. To worship other gods by serving them separates those who do so from the source of life and is Yahweh's definition of hatred. They make themselves enemies, thereby separating themselves from the truth of there being only one true Elohim of Israel. While standing in front of this edifice devoted to the worship of many pagan gods, Yeshua extols the significance of Peter's exclamation of him as the promised seed, the Messiah of the rock, who is the only living Elohim. This is the one who inherits, possesses, occupies the gate of his father's enemies. Many reading this will say to themselves, "Well, I don't hate God, I don't worship idols or graven images." Here again is seen the consequence of setting aside Yahweh's words. Yeshua upheld the words of his Hebrew father when he said that what we worship is what we serve. What we serve is what we give ourselves to. People say what they believe, but they do what they value. A graven image is the definition of an idol. How many Christians worship an image of the cross without an understanding that it has become the Nehushtan spoken of in Scripture and that Yeshua said he would become in John 3:14-15? Thus, those clinging to their idol become separated from, placed in conflict with, and enemies of the only true Elohim of Israel, the source of life, without even being aware of it. Following the tradition of men handed down to them that says the original words of the Elohim of Israel are of no consequence anymore, places them in a tragic position of ignorance in regard to the truth of all Scripture, including the Messianic writings, which were written by Hebrews from a unique historical Hebrew perspective. Yeshua said to him, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words, and the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me." John 14:23-24.